You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. There are certain locations around the world that for those of us who love the strange, the very mention of a certain place instantly conjures up a famous case. From Roswell to Loch Ness, Phoenix to Ape Canyon, and of course, one of the most famous, is Point Pleasant. What began that cold November evening in 1966 still fascinates us to this very day. And of course, the fulcrum of this classic tale of high strangeness is none other than the Mothman. Joining me to dive into this cauldron of weirdness is the marvellous Steve Ward. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. A big thank you to my latest patrons, Bob and Dave. Thank you for joining the gang. And to each and every one of you that continue to support me and the show. Your support is greatly appreciated. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media channels. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes and Mysteries and Monsters merchandise. Our intro and outro music are performed by the brilliant Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. A sleepy town in West Virginia would never be the same again after the arrival of the Mothman. It's the autumn of 1966, and the sleepy town of Point Pleasant is about to become world famous thanks to the story of four terrified teenagers. From that point on, the term Mothman became embroidered into the very fabric of the Mountain State, celebrated every year in its fabulous festival. Who else can help us unravel the mystery of Mothman than the marvellous Steve Ward? Steve, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Well, thanks for having me on. I was looking forward to this.
Oh, the feeling is very mutual, Steve. The feeling is very mutual. You've become synonymous with this particular subject, Steve, but I think sometimes a researcher or a sharer of Fortean knowledge such as ourselves can often find us. We may feel a bit pegged in sometimes by certain cases, and I think you certainly know this case so much as it is almost as if you've been embroiled in Mothman since you were a young man.
Well, yeah, as I mentioned earlier, that it that sighting with chase the two couples went all over the world, even the Stars and Stripes newspaper. And, you know, I was a few months before that, in March of 1966, we had a wave of UFO sightings. And these were the ones that became kind of infamous because Dr. J. Allen Hynek came down from Project Blue Book. He was still attached to the Air Force at that time. And he said that some of these sightings might be swamp gas. And of course, the swamp gas jokes have reverberated for decades.
Yes.
So, and that was, it's funny because 10 years later, he spoke in Ann Arbor, Michigan, one of the areas where they were seeing these things. He was had separated from the Air Force. He was had started the Center for UFO Studies and, you know, became one of the good guys. He the name of his talk was Swamp Gas Plus 10 and Counting. And so it was a serious talk, but there was a lot of humor in it, too, reflecting on the those days of 10 years before.
Was it UFOs that got you hooked into strange things then, Steve? Because often I think when we look back at sort of the 60s, it's quite hard to see what cultural exposure people had. Here in the UK, we were kind of very obsessed with two monsters, which was the Yeti and Loch Ness, and ghosts we weren't really inside UFOs that much. It wasn't as reported as much, and we didn't have access to wonderful magazines like you guys had over there, such as the wonderful Fate magazine, which is incredibly still running these days, and the like. Was it something that you were exposed to as a younger person, Steve, or did you have a relative that was into strange things, or was it just, as you say, being in Michigan, you got bitten by the UFO bug and it's ended up leading you into all kinds of high strangeness?
Well, I was always fascinated by science fiction and that sort of thing. And then to think that, some of these things could be real, that was really fascinating. So I did get hooked into that. We had my high school UFO club. We had a real classy name. It was the Aerial Phenomena Investigation and Research Center. And it was just a high school club with four guys. And we even published an amateur magazine that wasn't too bad, or about six issues or so. But that kind of set things up, I think. And then it was the following November that incredible sighting took place of the Mothman. And it was seen in what they call the TNT area. Mm. Now, it's always been nicknamed the TNT area. It's where they made explosives for World War II. And they stored them in 100 of these concrete bunkers. And it was long abandoned. They tore most of everything down after the war effort. And the one thing that was still standing was the old North Power Plant. Well, these two couples, they were driving, two married couples were out there driving around right by this plant, old North Power Plant. And Linda Scarberry said, what's that man doing standing in the road? Well, that man spread his wings by about 10 feet. They noticed the red eyes and it shuffled off toward the plant. And then that's when they took off and it chased him into town. You can visit the Mothman Museum and see the written reports that they gave the police. They separated. They separated them when they got there. Excuse me. And Jeff Wamsley is the man that has co-founded the Mothman Festival, and also is the curator of the Mothman Museum. He's really put together an incredible piece of history and folklore. You know, there's like five documentaries running at the same time. Mm. There's a gift shop, very, very high quality merchandise, but he's got all these displays and articles. He even has John Keel's white jacket, sports jacket.
Yeah.
And it got a nice display devoted to him and so forth. So it's, and people come from all over the world, from all over the U.S., all over the world, to make that pilgrimage.
Are you amazed, even though you love this case and this whole range of high strangers, because Mothman is simply the tip of the iceberg of everything that went on in Point Pleasant over that 13-month period, Steve?
Yes.
Are you amazed at just how popular Mothman has become around the world? Because as you say, the festival's been running for just over 20 years now. You've got the iconic statue. Obviously, Jeff's well known for this wonderful museum that you've got there. Does it surprise yourself, even as a lover of this particular case and the residents of Point Pleasant, just how far Mothman has spread around the world, even in the modern era?
Well yes, because it was, John Keel was being forgotten about for a long time. I think the Mothman Prophecies, the book that he covered all this, stayed in print. But a lot of his other books had gone out of print. And a lot of people didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
And I thought, heck, I've been like you. You know, I've been following John Keel for years. And so fortunately, a lot of his stuff has been republished. The thing that really kind of set it off was the movie, the Mothman Prophecies movie, which is about 20 years old now. And that brought a lot of people the consciousness of Mothman into their life.
I think it surprises me, I think, because obviously I was aware of Mothman before the film, obviously, because Keel had actually done a talk here in Sheffield in the UK in the mid-90s, Steve. And to this day, I can't explain why I didn't go, because I was all in, even at that point in 1996, I was all in on this subject then. I'd started reading the 14 times. I owned a copy of the Mothman Prophecies. I don't understand why I didn't go. That in itself is a case of high strangeness, I believe, Steve, because there's no rational explanation for me not doing that. And so it is peculiar. I remember listening to an interview that John did with Art Bell around the time the film came out. And the thing that struck me about that interview was the fact that he'd never been on Art Bell prior to that interview, which I found remarkable going on some of the characters that Art had on. The 90s.
Art Bell said, you know, I don't know much about the Mothman, you know, and I thought, you don't, this is, you know, Mothman was kind of the cornerstone of the paranormal. And yeah, it was, and there was even, there was another talk show host some time ago. He was talking about there was a chance that Keel was going to be going, speaking somewhere in Pennsylvania. This guy, he said, you know, I'm sorry, I don't, there's this UFO guy might be there, but I don't know his name, you know? And I thought, you don't know John Keel's name. That's just, it was mind boggling. But it's so good to see people reading the book. The book that really changed my thinking was Operation Trojan Horse.
Yeah.
That was when he pulls everything together. And I wasn't, you know, initially I wasn't real happy about it. I was kind of an ET guy. You know, I didn't want to be able to connect all these things. I wanted it to be separate, you know.
Yes.
And he sort of pulls you in when he wrote Strange Creatures from Time and Space, which has been retitled to The Complete Guide of Mysterious Beings, to Mysterious Beings. That's, he kind of pulls people in a little bit, start talking about window areas. But then, you know, you get the whole nine yards in Trojan Horse. And then, you know, you read the Mothman prophecies and you find out that half of that was cut out. And fortunately, much of it was restored in the Eighth Tower.
Yes.
So, you know, it's like a advanced college course in reading John Keel. And now there's a lot of anthologies of his articles that are out available.
Yeah, I was always remembering in that mid-90s period, I was always sort of lurking around thrift stores and charity shops, Steve, and I found a really battered copy of The Eighth Tower for about £1. And clearly the people selling it had no idea what it was. And I got it, and it was like literally falling to pieces. And I thought, well, I've got to get it. And it lasted about a year or two before it completely fell apart. And eventually, obviously, it got reprinted in a beautiful new version about 10 years ago, I think it was now. And I've had it ever since. And obviously, Operation Trojan I've got as well. So it's remarkable to me how there are some people who deal with the strange who seem to have completely missed Keel's work. Why do you think that is, Steve? Do you think he was big before it all became as widespread and culturally available sort of in the later 80s, early 90s, and by that point John had kind of taken a step back from it? Or do you think that it was just one of those things that he was never very sort of forward in pushing himself, whereas other people in that particular field of strangeness and ufology were front and center more?
Yeah, a lot of times I think he was kind of bored with the subject, you know. He wanted to talk about just about anything else other than Mothman. Now, one thing that he was up against, and I mean, I even remember it was an editorial in the Flying Saucer Review, which, of course, you know, is that I don't know if it's still being published anymore, but it was from 1955, the great British magazine on UFOs. There was, I think it was Gordon Creighton, did a kind of editorial. And what it was is, you know, a lot of people did not like John Keel. They hated the message, and you know, they didn't want to hear about the paranormal connections. And in this editorial, again, I think it was Crichton, said that, you know, we're going to keep publishing John Keel's articles. He's not going to censor them or anything like that. So yeah, there was and still to this day, I mean, there's a lot of people are he's gotten more acceptance. And but, you know, there was just a time when, you know, there were people like that were just very nuts and bolts, flesh and blood, and they just didn't want to deal with the high strangeness.
I'm going to say, do you think it's because he wasn't boxed in to thinking it was the Space Brothers or alien technology? He was thinking outside of what a lot of other people were saying in those particular fields that kind of saw him pushed to the margins then, Steve?
Well, he actually did his research. He noticed that there were just hundreds of different types of craft. And, you know, a lot of times it would just, these things would sort of appear and disappear. He talked about solid sightings and soft sightings, I think the way he put it. He said a lot of these things were sort of like meandering lights, and he thought that might be the actual real part of the phenomena. He thought these things were, and he loved this word, transmogrification. He thought these were transmogrifications of energy, and even suggested that there might be a kind of a reflective factor, that we kind of are co-creating some of these images. But he said it didn't make sense when you actually analyzed these things. It didn't make sense to imagine that there are, you know, like hundreds of different types of ETs and so forth, and also some of these craft would change shape. There are a lot of problems with looking at this, you know, straight on.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that struck me very early on when I was reading his work. After reading, as you say, Steve, a lot of nuts and bolts research and explanations on the thing, that he seemed to be one of the few people that was thinking about what if, what else. And when, as you say, the more you read it, the more it became apparent that unless countless civilizations were popping by, right, there was a lot more to this than meets the eye. Because you would say, even on a common sense level, Steve, why would one particular race of creatures use numerous different shaped objects to visit the same place?
Right. And now he did actually backtrack a little bit in later years. He gave a great interview to Richard Toronto. Richard Toronto had done a lot of work on the so-called Shaver mystery. And Keel said that he had kind of rejected the ET hypothesis, but he backtracked a little bit and thought there was more than one answer to these things. And I think that's probably right. And he also used the word ultra-terrestrial because he wanted something that would be more inclusive, something perhaps extra-dimensional. And he borrowed that term from Ivan Sanderson. And he said he used it as kind of a literary device. But he, you know, I saw a clip from one of the documentaries that he did. And he said, you know, we really don't know what happened in Point Pleasant. We just, and it was like a three-ring circus of the paranormal. You know, you had strange lights going on all over the place. You had this Mothman creature. You had animal mutilations, classic haunting phenomena, poltergeist phenomena. In fact, a lot of the people the thing that makes it so difficult to try and figure out what the Mothman was is that, you know, the description was basically the same. 6-7 foot tall, roughly humanoid, 10 foot wingspan, but its behavior was bizarre. It didn't always flap its wings when it took off. A lot of people that saw it had an outbreak of poltergeist phenomena for a time when they got home. There was some people that actually saw it manifest in their bedroom. And there was just a couple of people had missing time as being in close proximity with this thing. So it was also seen a couple of times in proximity to strange lights. I don't know if they would call them craft or not, but that was why it's so hard to pin down what this thing was.
I suppose as well, it's one of those cases, as you say there, that there seems to be so much secondary phenomena that seem to be occurring as well, because As you say, not only have we got the poltergeist, we've got the strange lights in the skies, we've got these areas of fear that seem to appear in certain areas. You'd got people having these premonitions, even though sadly none of them could pinpoint exactly what they were being told, if they were being told, that's the what was coming down the line for everybody. You'd got weird people turning up, the men in black harassing people. You'd got just incredibly strange events that all seem to start from this major sighting. Because one of the things I've never been able to kind of pinpoint, Steve, so you might be able to help me here, is obviously for most people who look at the Mothman case, it all begins with the Scarberries and the Mallets on, I think, was it 15th of November 66. When did the graveyard story first start appearing? Did that come out at the time as somebody said, oh, well, we think we saw something the week before?
You know, I don't know when it was reported. It took place 2 or 3 days before that, and before the Scarberries and the Mallets. But, you know, I don't know if it was something that was told much later. I don't have the date on that.
Yeah.
But you know, you just had all kinds of bizarre phenomena going on.
I suppose as well, the thing that always strikes me about this is that it's one of those cases, Steve, before we dive into everything, And I tax your patience and your knowledge, no doubt. In regards to this, is that I think when people come to try and explain it all away and say that everybody who saw this was an idiot and couldn't identify a bird or whatever, regardless, is the fact that that's just a tiny bit of everything that went on over that period. And it's one of those phenomena that people try and focus on one particular aspect of it without looking at anything else. And they think, right, well, if I've explained that, none of the rest matters. Or they've no interest in everything else, Steve. They only want to focus on the sightings of this alleged creature that numerous people saw. And so do you think that's people who have no interest in looking at the big picture, or they just want to focus on something that they can put forward a ready-made explanation for?
Well, you know, some people, they have a different focus. I know of a researcher, you know, there's been a lot of alleged sightings of a Mothman-like creature. Yes. In the Chicago area. Now, a lot of those are questionable, but there is a researcher that firmly believes that that's the same Mothman that migrated over there from years past. And one of the problems, well, there's a lot of problems with it, I think, but one of the main problems is that in these reports, you're not getting the high strangeness aspects. I mean, it's strange enough to see a winged humanoid if it's yes, you know, really happening, but all the other stuff, the high strangeness, the paranormal aspects, didn't seem to show up. Now, I know I have a couple of sources from MUFON that told me that when these sightings started, several of them were coming from the same IP address. And there's a great researcher named Allison Jornland who did a lot of footwork.
Yes.
Years ago and discovered that, you know, a lot of these, in some cases, people may really be seeing something, but it's just very questionable. But that's the one thing that you don't even hear in these reports is the high strangeness aspect.
I mean, there are a lot of strange things that seem to have grown up around Mothman since the key period, Steve. You've got these kind of anecdotal stories of things being seen in the past, which for anybody who's interested in the 40 and all the strange, alarm bells usually go off if somebody starts talking about something that happened 20 years ago that nobody's mentioned until something else has become popular. And you've got, obviously, as I'm sure you're aware, these allegations that the Mothman is some kind of harbinger of doom or death or despair. And
and
I'm sure you've probably seen as many as I have, if not more, Steve, of people saying, oh, well, they saw it at Chernobyl, which was something I hadn't seen in print. You know, and I'm not saying that I'm some kind of encyclopedia of strange reports, Steve, but I didn't see anything about that until the early noughties. There was nothing throughout the 90s regarding that at all. Other places where people had claimed to have seen it before, major disasters and earthquakes and things like that. With the greatest of respect, do you think things like that are people trying to create an increased mythos? Because I don't understand why you have to try and add to what happened at Point Pleasant. I think everything you've got there is more than enough.
Well, there are people that in this realm that do just that. And I think that the truth, the reality, you know, when we listen to people in the reports, and we have to try to qualify them, but you don't need to embellish. This stuff is fascinating, just the way it is. Sometimes stories just get told and retold, and, you know, a little embellishment here. And matter of fact, I had a chance to talk to Richard Haddam. He is the screenwriter for The Mothman Prophecies, and he thinks that when he created this stuff about Chernobyl and all that, he thinks that kind of went into the mythos. You know, he didn't really happen. You know, he didn't really read about it. So, and it was very cool because it turned out John Keel loved his script. And, you know, even though they took liberties with the book, obviously, Sandra Martin, John Keel's literary agent, was speaking to Brent Raines. Brent Raines has a great book out called John Keel, The Man, the Myths, and the Ongoing Mysteries. And she told Brent Raines that Keel was so happy, he was laughing, because, you know, he thought they got a script that captured some of the basic ideas. Prior to that, I'd seen scripts where they're just trying to turn Mothman into a monster or whatever. So, and Richard Haddam didn't know this. He didn't know that Keel was out there praising his screenplay. So he thought that was pretty cool.
I have seen quite surprising comments of people who have said, well, I didn't really like the film. I don't understand why Keel did. And I think when you're trying to bring a book and a phenomenon like this to the screen in whatever way, and clearly it's had a massive effect, because I think for a lot of people, Steve, it was their first introduction into this mystery. And therefore, as you say, that's an excellent point about the fact that this whole Chernobyl thing seems to have appeared unsurprisingly around the same time the film came out, which is, you know, I'm sure people can make a direct correlation between reality and what existed before the film's release. So going forwards, I find it odd. I think I would put myself in that boat, because when I originally saw the film, I was really disappointed because I'd read the book. I rewatched it a couple of years ago and absolutely loved it. So I think it just shows that once you get to grips with things and understand the reality of transferring something from book to screen, I think you can give it leeway. And when you look at the book, you think, well, they can't really do all, because we'd be in the cinema for 10 hours, I think, if they did a direct cover of the book.
Sure. Well, I had the same negative reaction when I first saw it. I wanted, you know, and I understood why they weren't able to do more with the Men in Black stuff. Because, you know, there were two silly films,
yes,
that were released, comedies, and you know, any direct connection with that would have just made it look silly. In fact, those films, Men in Black, were inspired by a graphic novel, and the graphic novel was inspired by the, call it history or folklore or whatever, and the two characters, Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith, J&K. John Q.
Which I think a lot of people miss. Anybody that was aware of the Men in Black certainly got that nod, because it was certainly playing to a specific crowd there.
Right. But I agree with you. I've come to really love the film, and I've watched it many times. So, and boy, it's got a great film soundtrack to go with it, too.
It has. It's a real work. And I think it's one of those that, as perhaps as we mature and we're not so precious as we both seem to be about this particular case, I think we've mellowed and appreciated what they were trying to do. And clearly, as I said, it's had such an effect on this that you can look at the knowledge base or the reach of Mothman prior to the film and everything afterwards, and it's obviously incomparable, isn't it, really?
Well, John Keel, he loved Alan Bates.
Yes.
Playing Dr. Leek, and he said he reminded him of him.
High praise indeed, Steve. So, one of the wonderful things about you and your life is that as we go back to that November night with these two couples who were hanging around, because the TNT area by this point, I believe, Steve, had become something of a lover's lane, or where the young people right. like to hang out and spend some time away from the prying eyes of the adults of the local town. And so you've got these two couples, the Scarberries and the Mallet. One of the interesting things about all this, before we dive into everything that happened, is that whilst everybody seemed to be quite open about talking about what happened that first evening with these two couples, Steve, I didn't realise for quite a long time, probably, I don't know, till about 10 years ago, that the Mallets seemed to stop talking to the press
yes.
very quickly after the incident. And I never really realised that until I look back, because I think there was so much going on, you can kind of miss where people kind of drift away from the story, and it's quite clear. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but they've never spoken about what happened in the modern era, have they?
No. They had those news conferences and so forth, and then they just wouldn't talk about it. I actually met Mary Mallet's sister some years ago, and she just doesn't talk about it.
These guys have had the, I mean, this is the one thing that's always been quite compelling about this first particular incident, is that we've got these four people. Linda sees this strange creature. They try their damnedest. Everybody gets terrified. They breakneck speed, get out of there. Roger's driving like a Formula One driver, Steve, to get them out of there. They're absolutely terrified. And this is one of those things about small towns, is people knew who they were. They knew they weren't the type of characters to just create some kind of wild story to get right. some attention, which is another thing that often gets pointed at people who have these experiences, Steve. So when they've had this experience, was it they go to the local, was it the local diner they went to first?
Well, actually, they went to, it was a Tiny's restaurant, and Linda worked there.
Yeah.
And she went, they knocked on the door, they were just closing, and her boss is the one that recommended that they go to the police. And so they did. And I was able to speak to Linda Scarberry a few times before she passed on. And, you know, there's another story that Jeff Wansley found out that adds credibility to what happened that night. A former nurse that worked at the local hospital there said that two women were admitted that night to be handled for stress. They would have a nervous breakdown is what happened. And so these women were admitted, and I don't know exactly what they did. But so then Jeff went back to Linda Scarberry and said, did you and Mary, were you admitted to the hospital later that night? And she said, yes. So there's just another corroborating story that something really happened.
I think one of the interesting things about Jeff, as we've mentioned, is he's, you know, the guy that he is the Mothman Museum, really, Steve. Wasn't he Linda Scarberry's paper boy or something crazy like that?
He lived on the same street as some of the witnesses. And yes, he was her paper boy. He was about 6 years old when all this happened. But, you know, how cool is it to grow up in a town where the monster, you know, and all this intrigue. And I wish that I had I didn't have a driver's license, so I couldn't play UFO investigator and go off to West Virginia. But and so fortunately, it was his father that started collecting articles and so forth on the bridge collapse. And so over the years, he, you know, it used to be across the street in a smaller building, but he just keeps expanding and expanding, and he has so much stuff that he doesn't have room for. Yeah, that's really that was really something.
Yeah, I mean, it must be akin to, I mean, I don't know if you know anybody, Steve, who lives on the same street Linda Scarberry lived on. Do you know anybody?
I think Jeff's mom still lives there.
Yeah,
on that street.
Yeah, and you don't live too far away from.
No, I live on the very road that the Scarberries and the Mallets were chased. And I'm just a few streets away from where the Silver Bridge once stood.
Yes, yes. I mean, obviously, one of the things that, I suppose it surprises me, obviously, living in the UK, Steve, sometimes we can look at some of these cases that have happened over the years where you've got creatures and incidents being reported, and all of a sudden, the news gets out, and then everybody seems to turn up. You get every monster hunter from every state, because obviously West Virginia is one of those places where it's landlocked and it's not the biggest state in the US. So you had groups of young men turning up armed to the teeth, driving around trying to bag themselves a Mothman, didn't you?
They had their shotguns and bow and arrows and wanted to bag themselves a Mothman. I can tell you a story. There was a lady that again is no longer with us. She was ran a beauty parlor in town. And some of us were over there during a festival one time. And she said, now, I don't know where this was. It was another kind of a lover's lane or a bunch of people were parked. She said a couple guys drove up. They had two big feather pillows, threw them up in the air and blasted them and yelled, Mothman. And she claims everybody cleared out within 2 minutes.
I mean, the thing about the TNT area as well, Steve, and I know this might have happened since, but at the end of the day, this was an old munitions dump, was it not? This is where, yeah, they stored things. Was it during the Second World War or afterwards when they...
Operating at the Second World War, and they had 100 of these concrete bunkers or igloos, and they were covered with foliage. So if the enemy ever flew in this far, it would just look like terrain. And you can still go out there. You can't drive around in a lot of the areas anymore, but you can pull off the side of the road. You can walk down some of the igloo roads. We even have directions in the Mothman Museum if people want to go out there and brave the dark. We also take people out there during the Mothman Festival.
Mm.
Our Mothman Festival happens every third weekend in September. And the only thing that costs, but we have speakers Saturday and Sunday. You know, there's thousands of people. There's souvenirs, there's food, T-shirts, everything. And the only thing that costs a couple bucks is to get a ticket for the TNT Hayride. Hmm. And what we do is we have three tractors. We go out to the farm museum, which is in the TNT area. There are three carts. Two of them have, you know, hit bales of hay on them, like a proper hayride.
Yeah.
They usually give me the old man cart with the nice, comfortable seats, which is very nice.
Yes.
And, you know, we go into this creepy area, and the men in black try to turn you away. They've got megaphones and bullhorns, and fortunately, they're a lot more like the Keystone Cops than the real men in black. Guarantee flyover of the Mothman. a couple of my friends, John and Tim, they portray the Men in Black by day, and at night they take this Mothman figure that's hanging in the museum and run him down a wire. They have this ingenious low-tech hand crank delivery system, and they blast a sound effect, and they light up his eyes with battery power. And I spent a few days putting up giant spider webs and big furry critters and lighting up their eyes and that kind of thing to give a little more I don't know, a little more like a Halloween hayride event. But the real star is that area. It's so creepy, and when you have a guaranteed flyover of the Mothman, it doesn't get much better than that.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't one of the silos explode in the last 10 or 15 years, Steve?
It was, yes, it was 2010, I think. And I was living in Michigan at the time, but three of us came down afterwards to see it. And a lot of these were rented out for private use, and somebody had stored some explosives in there. This wasn't left over from World War II. This was something that, you know, he wasn't supposed to be dealing with. Yes. And these two guys, John and Tim, they were on that very road that night. Now, fortunately, one of them got some bad pizza, and they went back to the motel early. So. Now they could have been, you know, very close. I mean, I don't know how far some of the debris went, but they narrowly missed that. Anyway, we went down the week after, and you could see the concrete top was blown off. The iron doors were blown out, and now when you go there, it looks like, if you remember the movie The Time Machine with Rod Taylor.
Yes.
Rod Taylor. In the beginning, you see this kind of old dome. It's kind of overgrown with bushes and everything. That's kind of what it reminds me of. It's really creepy looking.
Goodness me. I mean, when I first heard the story, Deep, I was thinking, is this some old munitions that people haven't picked up? But I would imagine, obviously, as you say, once it had served its purpose, it was essentially cleaned up and just left to rot then.
Right. Some of them are locked up. Some of them are used by the government, I'm sure. And I know a lot of people have used them to store things in, but it's a very atmospheric area, especially at night.
I think, looking at the whole case, one of the people I think who often gets overlooked, who I think is one of the key heroes of the whole thing, is Mary Hyatt from the local newspaper, Steve.
Yes.
Who her relationship and the dynamic her and John Keel built up throughout that. It's quite surprisingly touching, I think, because here we have this sort of very normal lady who's dealt with the usual kind of local news stories, cow gets free, car breaks down, drink driving, small town America, nothing much happening at night. You know, you might have a bit of delinquency back there, and maybe some kids have been playing some music too loud or racing about or whatever. And so for her to go from this kind of very sort of staid and dyed-in-the-wool small-town American news reporter to becoming sort of John Keel's partner in crime throughout all this, I think especially as to what happened, because she passed on very quickly after the whole events. I think she passed away in the early 70s, wasn't it, Steve?
I think it was 1970.
Yeah. And I think she often gets overlooked in all this, because a lot of the things that Keel ended up investigating and reporting on, Mary was right with him every step of the way, wasn't she?
Yeah. They would. There was a place, and I think we even found it. If you go a few miles south of Point Pleasant to Gallipus Ferry, and you go way back in the hollers, John Keel in the book, he calls it Five Mile Creek Road, but he purposely kind of obscured things so that people wouldn't do what we were doing out there, you know, bothering people trying to find UFOs.
Yes.
But it was that hill, or there was probably several of them, but they would go out there at night, and, you know, if you think 50 years ago, how, you know, desolate that some of that area might be. I mean, you can get lost in those hollers as today, you know, if you don't know what you're doing. And so they had almost every night these strange lights would be going over. And and also they had the experience, if you go kind of in that same general area, the chief cornstalk hunting grounds. He saw these strange purple lights that seemed to be alive. They even came down, and he didn't cover this in all of it in the book. I heard a lecture he gave. They actually, he was flashing his flashlight at it and at them. And they actually came down and surrounded him and then took off. And he noticed in one of the valleys, he noticed how it was all lit up purple. Mm. And he asked a local farmer about it. And he said, yeah, when that happens, you know, we don't go there, because one of his dogs ran in there one time and never returned. Mm. So this whole area is just filled with mystery. And, you know, one thing we should probably mention, the prophecies part of the Mothman prophecies.
Yes.
Where Kiel was in, and this is, you know, where it's so weird. Kiel was in contact with many individuals that firmly believed they were in contact with other intelligences, like, you know, the Indrid Cold thing, the Mr. Apple, APOL, in the book.
Yeah.
And a lot of this stuff, I don't know how physical it was. A lot of it seems like it might have been channeling. You know, people were getting these messages or whatever. But leading up to December 15th, when the bridge collapsed, December 15th, 1967, people were getting these prophecies, and a lot of them were coming true. I mean, it was just really freaky, like plane crashes and that sort of thing. And but then they sort of, many of them coalesced, and he was saying there's going to be a big event. They called it the EM effect, and I don't know really what, you know, if they don't know if they meant electromagnetic or whatever. Mm. But this EM effect was going to take place on December 15th, and it was the moment that President Johnson lit the Christmas tree on the White House lawn.
Yes.
That's when, I forget the exact prophecy, but it was going to be 3 days of darkness and, you know, a lot of terrible things going on. Well, by this time, Kiel, and he you know, one of the chapters in his book, I think, is Paranoiacs Are Made, Not Born. And he was holed up in his New York apartment with water and candles, and he was ready. And then Johnson lit the Christmas tree, and nothing happened. A few moments later, a bulletin came over that the bridge that connected Point Pleasant to Ohio had collapsed. And he was furious, because, you know, that something, some intelligence, some force was giving information. But it was like misdirection. It was like the trickster that we hear about. So that's the prophecies part, pretty interesting. And there's a couple other books out called The Big Breakthrough and The Big Blackout. And during this time period, Kiel had bought into a lot of these messages. And there's a great passage in The Eighth Tower where he talks about how he was embarrassed now that he bought into some of that stuff, because it was just, a lot of it was just nonsense and gibberish and so forth. But again, you had all these people, and he called them silent contactees. Hmm. Because for the most part, they weren't running, you know, out to the TV station to be interviewed. They didn't care. They just thought, this is really happening. And, you know, I'm going to, they would get certain quests to perform. One, Kiel said there was one of the contactees was trying to find a crucifix in Brooklyn somewhere, and it was going to have some magical powers or whatever. So some of it was just, was nonsense. Yeah. And you know, the way when, and it's a fascinating area when you get into channeling, seances, mediumship, there is a lot. Some of the messages that come through are accurate, and you can, you know, check back through history about the person that died and verify facts. But then there are huge gaps. There's some of it that is just, it's just nonsense. And I think that's, you know, I was reading a really interesting book called Hungry Ghosts by Joe Fisher.
Yes.
And are you familiar with that one?
Yes, yes, quite. It's a very, very striking book with a tragic real story to it, isn't it?
Yes. And he, you know, he went to Greece, he went to England, and was able to verify some of the stuff. But then he would come back and he'd be speaking to supposedly the spirit through the medium. And, you know, the spirit, or whatever it was, would be arguing with them. You know, you must have done something wrong. You made a mistake or whatever. But yeah, that's an eye-opening book.
Yeah, It certainly is. I think this is the thing as well, because once again, there are so many facets to this whole thing that often get overlooked. Because as you say, by the time Keel sat down, sort of holed up in his apartment, expected the end of the world or something similar, Steve, he'd already been dealing with people tampering with his phone lines and strange things going on in his apartment. You know, he was convinced people were getting in. I mean, he ended up going down to the telephone exchange and finding it, because he was getting bills in the thousands and calls, all the calls. And that one incident, he picked the phone up and somebody was on the line already. So it's not surprising, because I suppose when you've got all this going on, and as you mentioned earlier, you've got what's going on with Indrid Cold, you've got these people turning up in the black suits and the strange cars, you've got the interviews going on, people trying to kidnap witnesses, which I think happened to
Connie Carpenter,
yeah, because she was the lady also had the aspects with her eyes as well, didn't she? Didn't her eyes all swell up as well?
Yes, she saw it at the Mason County Golf Course.
Yeah.
And it flew over her car. And that's another thing that Keel has pointed out, that people that have, call them monster experiences, Bigfoot or whatever, and UFOs, often they suffer from the same physical ailments. They, you know, like conjunctivitis, like eye burn, thirst, muscle aches, and so forth, suggesting that there may be a link between some of these things. And, you know, Keel began to be less interested in what the creature looked like, what the spaceship looked like. He said he wanted to understand the cosmic mechanism behind these things. And he was just so far ahead of his time. And, you know, it's interesting. You go back and look at Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Mm. He wrote a book called, I think, The Coming of the Fairies.
Yes.
And he firmly believed in these elementals.
Yeah.
But he said, interesting, he said, the appearance of the fairies are largely dependent on the person viewing them.
Mm.
Sound like John Keel. It's too bad that these two guys could not have had a conversation. Mm. Remember the line in the Mothman Prophecies, it depends on who's looking. I can't remember the exact quote, but when Richard Gere is talking to Dr. Leake.
Mm.
Anyway, so that's there's a whole realm there of Some of it does seem to be physical.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to be surprised at all when you hear about some of these bizarre incidents in South America with people being attacked by and trying to be kidnapped by these things. Some of it just seems like it has a real physicality to it. One other thing I wanted to mention, you know, all that weird stuff that was happening with John Keel. Now, some of it was obviously paranormal, but I found out that he had written a critical article on J. Edgar Hoover's FBI.
Mm.
2 weeks later, a lot of this harassment that's reported in the Mothman Prophecy started. So some of that was very real and, you know, very very physical. And, you know, they gave him a rough time.
Yeah. Well, if there's one thing J. Edgar Hoover didn't like was criticism of any kind, Steve. I think that's history has shown that he didn't take any criticism, didn't like anybody giving him or pulling up the FBI or what they were up to or anything like that. So, I think, once again, it's one of those things that you kind of understand why Keel had got into this mindset by the end of it. But on top of all that, you know, you've got the situation that was happening, as we were saying about these prophecies, because was it Mary that was kept having the dream about seeing the presence in the water?
Yes, Mary Heyer and Mrs. Thomas, and also there's another lady, Linda Sigmund, who's a friend of mine. She lives in the Parkersburg area. When she was 16, she saw the Mothman, and this was April 67, and she and her boyfriend were about 12 miles north of Point Pleasant. They're just sitting on the hood of the car at night, and they saw this strange light, and they decided to get out of there. And then there was actually some missing time, but he wanted to drive out of there, and then she saw the Mothman. She saw it near this light, and he did not see it. She wanted to go back and see it again. She was sticking her head out the window to get a good look at this thing. Now, she had missing time and had a really bizarre experience. But also, in December of 67, she had gone to downtown Point Pleasant. And now this is just like a couple of weeks before the bridge collapse. And she went to the store and she saw this strange looking guy there with black suit, sunglasses, fedora, and there was something wrong with his skin, kind of grayish.
Yeah.
And he's just leaning up against the building, and she comes out and she looks down the street, and there's another one, looks just like this guy standing by a lamppost. And she just thought, boy, is that weird? And then years later, when she read the Mothman prophecies, she put it all together and thought, my God, these were classic Men in Black.
Do you think if any other investigator had taken it upon themselves to go down there, Steve, that they'd have missed all the secondary things that were going on? Because I think often when you deal with high strangeness, and I know, I think, you know, there's a famous quote, I think Keel said, when you're investigating things, you ask people what they had for breakfast, because
yes,
you need to find out what else, because it's often people will tell you what they think you're interested in rather than telling you about everything that's going on. And I think you can see this in people that specialize in one particular phenomenon, even into the modern era, that if people are looking for Bigfoot, they're only interested in Bigfoot. They're not interested in people seeing strange lights or UFOs or black cats or other weird things or poltergeist manifestations or anything like that. People see ghosts, they're not bothered about strange lights in the sky. And yet, for somebody like Keel, because he seemed so open to the world of high strangeness, he was interested in strange creature sightings, weird contactees turning up, all these poltergeist manifestations, strange men in black, his phone lines being tapped. I think anybody else, perhaps, maybe with the exception of one or two researchers, would have completely missed so much of the other weird things that were going on.
There was one, I think his name was Franzen, a Swedish researcher. And if I recall correctly, he had helped out John Keel with the research into the ghost flyers, and the ghost yes. planes that showed up in Scandinavia in the 30s.
Yeah.
And so he actually followed Keel in maybe a year or two later, and he found, because he was a student of Keel, he did find a lot more stuff. He found other people that had a poltergeist experiences after they saw the Mothman. So a lot of people, no, they just wouldn't, they would have missed so much. And that, I love that quote, you know, ask the experiencer what he or she had for breakfast. And, you know, I talked to a lady a few years ago. She contacted me on Facebook, and she told him, she and her husband had missing time. At that point, she had not made a breakthrough with a therapist, but they were standing out on their front porch early one morning, and they're looking at these strange lights coming toward them. And then all of a sudden, they're not standing next to each other anymore. They're quite a ways apart, and they look up and they see this large black triangle brushing the tops of the trees. And then, as happens in so many of these cases, it didn't register then. They went back went to bed, and later on, they thought, well, that was weird, you know? And then she knew they had missing time, about a half hour. So I asked a series of John Keel questions. And to make a long story short, it turned out that they were experiencing classic haunting phenomena in the house, electrical disturbances. Both her sons were seeing orbs in the house and outside the house. She saw a shadow person. And then I asked her, I said, you know, this is going to sound weird, but have you ever seen some kind of an animal you couldn't identify? And she said, no. And then she said, well, wait a minute. My mother-in-law and sister-in-law both saw something near the property, and they saw it twice. And it was like a black panther, but standing on two legs.
Hmm.
So if I was, you know, that kid back in the 1960s, and I heard her story, I would have said, well, I hope you make that breakthrough. But I would have had no clue to ask all these other questions. But people like John Keel, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, another great lady that we lost recently.
Yep, yep.
She was another one, and a good friend and colleague of John Keel's.
Mm. It's something that stayed with me for quite a long time, because I spoke to Tony Healy about three or four years ago, Steve, and he said exactly the same. He said there are so many incidents in his career where he's always followed John Keel's mantra of get the whole picture, not just the experience you're interested in, because you will often miss clues or correlations, once again, leading into this cosmic trickster manifesto, as it were, that if you only focus on what you think you're interested in, then you're going to miss it. And it makes you wonder, in this day and age, how many strange things are often not reported when we deal with weird phenomena across across the world, Steve?
Well, sometimes people I've talked to investigators, and some of the witnesses will, for a while, will withhold certain details because they're, you know, if they saw a Bigfoot, that's strange enough. But if the Bigfoot was translucent, you could see through it, they you know, they won't tell you some of that at first. That just seems to happen time and time again. And but also, conversely, you get I talked to both, well, Rosemary and Stan Gordon. They told me that there have been times when they talked to somebody that gave their experience. And when they had talked to a different researcher, sometimes a researcher would say, oh, listen, I don't want to hear about Bigfoot. I want to hear about that UFO you saw. Or, you know, I don't want to hear about the UFO. I want to hear about your Bigfoot story. And so, and it's really funny because a guy I know, Brian Seach, they went out to an area in Pennsylvania one time that's known for, you know, people hearing Bigfoots and having encounters. They didn't see a Bigfoot that night, but they saw a strange object, a light that was, you know, zigzagging around and making crazy maneuvers. So that wasn't a bad deal. You know, you look for Bigfoot and get a UFO.
Well, as with anything, I think it's vitally important in this day and age, especially because, you know, when we're talking about Keel's work, obviously, you know, we're talking about a catalogue of events that happened 56, 57 years ago now, Steve. And yet, for me, you will often see people who say that they're Fortians, but they only seem to specialise in certain parts of Fortiana. They're not Fortians, they're cryptozoologists or they're paranormal researchers. They're not Fortians because, with the greatest respect, if you're a Fortian, you're interested in all of it. And the one thing I've learned doing this show is that I always used to think I was really open-minded. Always. I now know I was nowhere near. My third eye was not even there, Steve, never mind being opened. And I think doing this show and speaking to other researchers of the ilk of people like Tony Healy and Nick Redfern and yourself, is that I've come to realise that I was one of those people that I thought I was a Fortian, but I wasn't. I was interested in certain aspects of phenomenon and didn't really want to know the backstory. And so, if anything, I've gone back to how Keel would have reported it or investigated it by saying, right, why is that happening? What else is happening? Where were they? What else have they seen? Do they know anybody else that's having strange things? Rather than saying, right, what did you see?
And Keel never liked to be called a ufologist.
No.
He called himself a Fortian. that was a bad word to John Keel, I think.
Well, coming after their 50s and some of the characters that were bobbing about in that particular field, I'm not surprised, Steve. So I suppose as well, I mean, one of the great aspects of this, one of my favourite sightings out of all this is the couple that go and visit, I think, did they go and visit the sister and brother-in-law or something, and they weren't there, the kids are there,
yeah,
and it just
Marcella Bennett,
yeah, the Marcella Bennett incident, I think, for me, Steve, I don't know about you, for me, I think that's the my favourite Mothman encounter in that particular period, because it's one of those where, yes, you could say, if you were of that nature, that the Scarberries misidentified an owl or a sandhill crane or whatever large bird somebody can throw at the case. This one, you can't, because you'd got so much going on, and a woman who seems to be frozen twice or paralysed twice on two separate occasions, people seeing it, this thing hanging around, walking around on the porch outside.
Yeah,
this is not. Yeah, this is not a bird, Steve.
No, you know, John Keel. It's interesting because he would use the term ultra-terrestrial, but he would use it interchangeably sometimes with elemental. Mm. And I'm wondering if maybe that's a better way. Not that I'm sure I can give a good description of what an elemental is, but that may be the area that we need to consider, and we're trying and figure out what some of these things are.
So in regards to Marcella's incident, Steve, could you give us a synopsis for anybody who's not aware of it? Because I think this is one of those that gets completely overlooked, because everybody focuses on the Scarberry TNT incident. And I think this one seems to get missed for some reason. Is it because it happened so closely to the original one, do you think? Or do you think it's just that some people just don't really know much about it?
A lot of people don't know a lot. You know, they've got just little bits and pieces. She and her brother drove out. They heard about the Mothman, and they're going to tap on the window. and just trying to scare their friends. And so they weren't home. And so they were walking back to the car. Now, her brother was trying to get her attention. There was some kind of a light or UFO in the sky. And she didn't want any part of it. She just wasn't interested. And then this thing, it was as if it was laying on the ground. It stood up. She fell on her infant child. I mean, she just collapsed. And then she tried to get up and was it's like she couldn't move. Mm. And so they finally ran to the house and went inside, locked the door. And that's when this thing was sort of walking back and forth on the porch. And so, and there were kids there too, that saw it. There's Faye DeWitt, who's another witness, and she's not mentioned in the book, but there was same kind of thing. Her she was out there with her brother. I forget how old she was, but she had several of her siblings there, and her brother went out to they drove by the old North power plant, and again he thought it was a big joke, but they saw it, and she said it didn't look like it flew. It looked like it jumped up on the North power plant. And for a time it ran right by the car. And she's got this great accent. And she says, when she tells her story, it had the biggest, reddest eyes you ever did see. And that lady is still with us. So we still have a few classic Mothman witnesses, but so many of the old guard are gone.
Is Roger Scarberry still alive?
Yes. And he made some contact, some intermediary with me. He wants to talk to Jeff at some point. Mm. And he's been quiet for a long time. So I hope, you know, every once in a while somebody will surface. And, you know, even Jeff tells this great story about his mom. You know, he has several mannequins dressed like the Men in Black in the museum.
Yeah.
And so one day his mom said, what's that all about? What's that Men in Black all about? And so he tells her, and she says, oh, we used to see them in town. And he said, Mom, you know how long I've been doing this? And you're just telling me this now? And he said, where did you see them? Mary Heyer's office.
Oh. Blimey. Yeah, I'm going to say, I appreciate Jeff's frustration there. Oh, goodness. I mean, it is, some of it does seem implausible, I think, unless you kind of take a step back. Because I think, I know we've kind of said skeptics will try and explain it away as misidentified all kinds of creatures. But I think also, as we've been saying about the difference between being a Fortean and somebody who's interested in certain types of phenomenon, Steve, is that you'll get people who will try and explain what it was as much as people will try and tell you what it wasn't. And I think you've got numerous people who will say, oh, well, it's a cryptid, it's a tulpa, it's a paranormal entity, it's an alien, it's a robot. Do you think this is one of those cases where if you sit down and look at the cases and the witness statements, it can't be any of one of those things? Because as you say there, some people claim they saw it flap, some people say it shot up like a rocket, some people say it seemed to glide, some say it just appeared out of nowhere. You can't really sort of say that any of those types of behaviour would be one particular paranormal explanation, surely.
Right. That Mrs. Thomas, that was having those prophetic dreams, she saw it toward the end of that year. And she said it was sort of like it was gliding or walking really fast, more like a robot. But then there's the a minister and his wife. They were missionaries. They were going to leave the next day to go off to some far off country for several years. But he's on one of the documentaries called The Mothman of Point Pleasant, and it manifested in their bedroom.
Mm.
6-7 foot tall, red eyes, big bat-like wings, and they didn't know anything about it because the next day they left. And when they came back several years later, they're looking at all the reports, and they think, my God, that's what we saw in our bedroom. So, yeah, sandhill cranes don't do that.
Well, this is the other thing as well, that you've also, as often with these kind of explanations, you've got people who put different things forwards. And once again, well, they all can't be right. You know, sometimes, as you said earlier, Steve, I think sometimes when we're dealing with cases of high strangeness, there can be more than one answer, because, you know, even mathematics can tell us, even the simplest of sums will often have different ways of calculating it. You know, you can divide 8 by 4, but you can also divide it by 2. Neither of those answers are wrong. They both give you the same result. you will get the right answer. You've just done it in a different way. And I think when somebody says, well, I think it was an owl, and somebody else says, well, I think it was a crane, well, I think it's mass hallucination, which hasn't been proved. Somebody will say, oh, well, they were just overexcited. They all can't be right.
No, and then you get this incredible variety of cryptids, or whatever you want to call them. You know, we had the owl man,
yep,
over your way.
Yes.
And sometimes you'll get these, I call them one-off cryptids, like the Enfield horror.
Yes.
Out of,
yes,
Illinois.
Yes.
Three legs, pink glowing eyes, and arms protruding out of its chest. Mm. The Loveland Frogman.
Yes.
He was only seen a couple times,
yeah,
near the Little Miami River. And, yeah. Oh, it's the Dover Demon.
Yeah, one of my favorites.
Yep. He looks like a undernourished gray without a spaceship.
Yeah. They're some of the strangest ones. These kind of sticking out like a sore thumbs. They're not, you know, they're not your normal Bigfoot, Dogman, late monster, strange black cats. Or black shucks or anything like that, Steve. These are very odd-looking creatures of a variety of shapes, like you say. I mean, I wasn't aware of the Enfield case till about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, because I kept seeing the term the Enfield monster, and I kept thinking they were talking about the Poltergeist case from London. And
right.
I thought, and I just sort of thought, well, there's only so much you can read about one particular case that you don't, or that you've not already read. So to discover this weird cryptid lurking around scrapyards in Illinois was just like, what on earth is going on? Because that just doesn't, that's one of those that it can't be a mistaken identity, because that just doesn't sound like anything.
Well, and then are you familiar with the works of F.W. Holliday, Ted Holliday?
It's, yes, yes.
He corresponded with John Keel quite a bit. And by the way, Colin Wilson has a great book called Alien Dawn.
Mm.
Where he devotes an entire chapter to Jacques Vallée, but he also talks a lot about this correspondence that he had with John Keel. But, well, you know, you look at the Loch Ness Monster, right? His first book, F.W. Holliday's first book, was called The Great Orm, O-R-M, like the ancient word for worm, of Loch Ness. And and then, you know, he stumbled onto all this high strangeness. The first thing he did was he actually dealt with what people reported. People wanted to see it as a plesiosaur, but that didn't work. At first, he thought it was just maybe like some oversized mollusk or whatever. But then, you know, the way its elusiveness, the a lot of UFOs were seen there. There's Jan Sundberg.
Yep.
Was a Swedish researcher, and he gets twisted around your foyers, and he comes to a clearing, and he sees what he thinks is some kind of a submersible, and he sees these guys, or whatever they were, that he thinks have diving suits on, but they're not. They're some kind of humanoid. They get in this thing and take off. And then he dealt with going to some of the small lakes in Ireland.
Yes.
And, you know, some of these are, you know, maybe a quarter mile long or smaller, 30 feet deep, yet people are seeing these large critters in there. So, you know, how do we reconcile that?
Yeah, yeah. But the Loch Ness Monster as well, a couple of the early reports saw it slithering across land as,
yes,
well. You know,
yep,
there was the couple that nearly ran it over with the sheep in its mouth.
Yeah.
And that doesn't bear any resemblance to everything else that went on afterwards. And what people see now doesn't bear. No, I can't remember the last time anybody claimed to have seen something strange on the banks of the loch, Steve.
Right.
It's always inside it. I've been fortunate to go to Loch Ness. But like you say, there's all sorts happening around there. People see black cats around Loch Ness. There's ghosts. I mean, you've got a petrified prehistoric forest round the corner from Loch Ness. It's a very strange area at the best of times, and that's even before you get into what's going on under or on the surface of the loch.
Well, the cryptids and UFOs seem to go together. Stan Gordon's book, Silent Invasion,
yes,
about the southwestern Pennsylvania, 73, 74, seeing these bizarre Bigfoots, that sometimes will disappear in a flash of light in conjunction with strange looking craft. And if you go back to the great airship wave, 1897, Ohio, there's people were seeing this airship going around Ohio kind of clockwise on different days. And at the same time, in between, let's see, mid-April to mid-May, they were seeing these large black cats around Chillicothe and some other places. It looked kind of odd. It had like an oversized head and the legs were short. Mm-hmm. Sounds like some of the dog-like critters that were seen on Skinwalker Ranch. But and then also in Adams County, where the Serpent Mound is, they were seeing what they were calling a wild man. And obviously it was some kind of a Bigfoot. So you have, again, you always have this, what appears to be some kind of craft that's always a little bit ahead of us. And, you know, and then if we go to Elkhorn, Wisconsin, where Linda Godfrey had written a lot about the Dogman, I was privileged to go visit Lee Hample's farm. He's been working on the farm for about 10 years. His neighbors were telling him that, hey, you know, there's a werewolf that lives back there in those trees. and then at one point he sees it. He's seen it a couple times. He's had missing time there. He sets up these trap cameras, and he has literally thousands of pictures he's taken over the years. And every once in a while, he captures something that looks like some kind of technology. He's even captured like part of some kind of an animal. Yeah. But the thing is, there is some kind of intelligence or trickster involved, because so many times he's tried to get really good photographs and set up the cameras in such a way, but then they will fail. Or you know, just won't work at all. So here again, we have some kind of a bizarre something going on in the sky, very elusive, and then on the ground, you've got some kind of a strange animal, cryptid.
Because I've seen some of the trail cam pictures where this strange mist appears on it and then just seems to disappear, Steve, which makes no sense.
Well, he there have been a lot of roadkill deer on the property there, so he would take them off the road and put and set them up on his land and set up a trap camera. And you can tell it, you can see the timestamp. Mm. You'll see a mist roll in, and then it's gone.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, you don't, there's no tracks, there's no drag marks. And this has happened, I think, maybe 10 or 12 times.
Mm.
So he's got, you know, he's been trying to get people from universities or whatever interest. I mean, here you have on this acreage a virtual laboratory of the paranormal.
Mm.
I mean, you could probably make some headway if you were able to, you know, fund it properly and create strategies on how to try and capture some of this phenomena. But you know, people don't want to deal with it.
Well, it's one of those things. Is how strange is too strange, Steve? And I think Linda was excellent in building that rapport up with Lee to get his trust, because I suppose he may have felt that he once again would have been one of those people who was holding things back when he was trying to explain what was going on, as we've explained before with other people who have had strange encounters, Steve, that he may have said, oh, well, I think there's a strange dogman creature around here. And then all of a sudden you've got the mist. And then you've got the mist that's taking carcasses. And then you've got the footprints that just stop in the middle of a field as though something's just got an elevator to the sky or something.
And it's split. It was like you have a single pair of footsteps that looks like they split in two.
Yes.
They start nowhere and end nowhere. It's it's mind-numbing.
Mm. I mean, as you've continued to develop your love of the Fortean, Steve, is there anything that's going on recently or over the last few years that you've kind of thought John Keel would have loved this particular case? That's, you know, something that seems to be that's got a bit of everything. You know, we've got steak, chips, and all the salad with it. It's not just one particular phenomena.
Well, that's my interest. That's why I focus on places like the Skinwalker Ranch, and Lee Hample's farm and all these other things, because I suspect that may be one way we can make some progress. I mean, back in the old days, we just thought of all these things as being separate.
Yeah.
But now we know that's not true.
Hmm.
The thing that gets me is, like I say, some of these experiences. I mean, there may well be a Bigfoot-like creature that's flesh and blood and is hiding somewhere unknown. We may actually have some aliens, you know, messing with us, intermixing with all this. I don't know how the heck we'd be able to separate them. You know, if one is our transmogrifications of energy representing some kind of high strangeness, and then, you know, how do we separate the two? I've wondered at sometimes if there is an alien presence or extra-dimensional presence or whatever, if they recognize this sort of mechanism in human consciousness that seems to project or co-create some of this phenomena. Hmm. I wonder if they through force of will or technology could manipulate that somehow. Hmm. And maybe you know, for their own purposes, kind of mask what they're doing. I don't know. I wish I don't like that idea. I just want it to be one thing. I can only handle one thing on my plate, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's a very interesting aspect of it all, because I know often people will say, "Oh, well, nobody sees fairies anymore," which we know is palpable nonsense, because there are numerous witnesses from around the world, see, who clearly are having encounters with the small people on whichever sort of tradition you come from, be it British or tribal Americans, whatever. People have always had stories about small people, and they were dismissed as, well, nobody sees them anymore. People see greys anymore, which is one of those things where you think, well, not everybody who claims to encounter an alien sees a grey. Once again, you've right. got numerous characters from wherever turning up that people described. You know, it's one of those one-size-fits-all answers that usually is a very lazy response to a phenomenon where people just can't be bothered to look at it properly, I think, and sort of dismiss it as delusions or illness. And yet people are seeing pixies and fairies and goblins and hobs mm-hmm. and wizened old men and women and strange things. That, why are they seeing different ones then? Are we, as you say, is this a phenomenon that presents itself in the way it wishes to be seen? And if it is, why does it do that?
I don't know. You know, in the old days, when I give presentations sometimes, I talk about the good old days and when we used to have really cool aliens like the Flatwoods Monster and the Kelly Hopkinsville Goblins and so
yes,
forth.
Yes.
And then late 70s, you have Close Encounters of the Third Kind film.
Yeah.
And early 80s, you have Whitley Strieber's book Communion.
Yes.
And while you could find something that looked like a gray back in the old days, they weren't very plentiful. Mm. But that whole wave seemed to take off around that time period. So I don't, you know, it could be that the grays are flesh and blood, and they're the new kids in town, and they pushed everybody out, you know. But it's just interesting that although you can go back and look at some sometimes Swedish elves, they had like long arms and big bulbous heads.
Yeah.
You know, look kind of like maybe a pale gray.
Yeah.
So it's I forget the name of the guy that coined the term, the phantom menagerie. And
yes.
He's the guy. Oh, Omen. Dr. Mm. Donald Omen. He's the yes. one that did the exorcism on Loch Ness.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, he's an interesting character, too.
Yeah, yeah. But I know you were fortunate enough to speak to Alan Godfrey a few years ago on your show, I believe, Steve.
Yes.
And his sighting is another one. You know, here we have a typical no-nonsense Yorkshire policeman going on a hunt for stray cows wandering about.
Yeah.
Yes. And, ends up getting abducted, and once again numerous explanations have been put forward which basically ignores his experience about what happened. But one of the things that's always struck me about him is the fact that he reports seeing a dog on the craft, some yeah. kind of dog thing,
a large black dog. And when Jenny Randall's reported on it, she made the talked about the folklore of the black shuck.
Yes.
Yeah. And but also, you know, he had to deal with the displaced cattle.
Yes.
Because they ended up in a gated area. Nobody knows how they got there.
Yep.
One woman reported a strange light. There was this incident on the Skinwalker Ranch where the Black Angus bulls weren't in their pen, and they don't know how they got out. And then they look in this. Actually, what happened was the Shermans, they were another part of the farm or the ranch, doing some work, and then when they're driving back, Mrs. Sherman, you know, they're in the midst of all this craziness, disembodied voices, strange craft, strange creatures. And Gwen Sherman says, I pray nothing ever happens to those bulls. Well, when they got there, something did happen. And they found them in this trailer, this old trailer that hadn't been used. Mm. And they're alive, but they're crammed in there in kind of a stupor.
Yeah.
And, you know, they got them out. They had to re-corral them. But and then there's Dubbed Wales, the Dubbed Enigma.
Yes.
Holiday and Randall Pugh. There was an incident with the cows.
Yeah.
The Coombs family. A hundred of them were transported about a half mile away to another farm.
Yeah.
And then the next couple of days, he takes 16 of them out, puts them in a pen, goes in to turn on the milking machines, comes back, and they're gone. So we have this displaced cattle thing. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't. And I don't know. Oh, and they Pugh and Holiday, they made a lot of, you know, possible connections with things out of folklore.
Yeah.
And there's a tale out of Norway where the milkmaid, she puts her cow in the pen, goes to get the milk pail, and the cow is gone. And this keeps happening.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, one of the little people, one of the elementals, comes to her and says, "You can't put your cow there. It's spoiling our food." So they went speculating, well, what does that mean? I mean, are they elementals that derive food from earth energies or whatever? So, again, they weren't being dogmatic about it. They were just, you know, going back in folklore to see what they could discover.
Mm.
But the thing is, the moment that Gwen Sherman said, I pray nothing ever happens to those bulls, they did. It's almost like the trickster showed up again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know Paul Sinclair, when he was doing some of the reports for one of the early Truth Proof books, Steve, who does a lot of work on the east coast of Yorkshire.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He had an account from a farmer who had come down to his field looking for his sheep and found dozens of them all rammed into a sheep dip trough, like essentially crammed in. Some of them were upside down, like wedged in. They couldn't get out. And unfortunately, some passed on because they'd been put in. And you just think these little things that sometimes get overlooked in regards to these cases where you've got, as you say, with Alan Godfrey, all this started looking for some random cows that ended up being found on a locked rugby field. You know, and I've been to Todmorden, and I've walked that road where Alan had his encounter and up to the rugby ground.
Right.
So I know exactly where it all occurred. And it's one of those places where you think, well, there's no way anybody could be mucking about like that, because you've got like a massive row of houses all above the street. And anybody that's lived in the countryside knows cows are not the quietest of animals to be moving about at midnight, Steve.
No.
Especially a big herd of them, all sort of, even their clip-clop on the tarmac road would give your game away straight away.
Oh, right.
I mean, and that's before you even get into the more well-known phenomena of what's been going on with the cattle mutilation and the work that Christopher O'Brien's done, looking into all that and the work he's done over the last nearly 50 years now, goodness. And occasionally you'll see people say, is this still going on? And you only have to have a brief look. I know there's been a big issue with it happening recently in Oregon, and I think there was another one down in Texas as well in the last couple of years. So these things still happen. And these, once again, people say, oh, well, it's just animal mutilation. And I've seen people do a demonstration of leaving a cow corpse in a field and nothing happens to it.
Right.
For a week. And then it starts to decompose and the critters get into it and stuff. Things like that don't happen overnight in 24 hours.
Maybe we'll have to take up an easier profession.
But where's the fun in that, Steve?
Well, you're right. We wouldn't be baffled so much.
Oh, well, Steve, listen, it's been wonderful to pick your brains about Mothman and all manner of strange 14 things. What are you currently doing? Because are you still working at the Mothman Museum and helping out with Jeff?
Yeah, I work on Saturdays to answer questions and greet people.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the festival that happens once a year. And he sends a lot of interviews for me. He can't do them all. And so I do a lot of, but sort of publicity for the Mothman and for the museum.
So how's, because I know he's always expanding. The last I heard, which was, I think, towards the end of last year, he was on about adding an escape room and a Dayglo golf course, Steve.
Yeah, he's working. It's not done yet, but it's going to be really cool. Because part of it is like Mary Heyer's office. I think another part yes. might be an igloo. I don't know. He's also got upstairs a miniature golf course.
Yeah.
And it's one of these all lit up, you know, with fluorescent lights or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, ever since he retired, he's been like a crazy man expanding. They've got two other stores. They've got the one called Bunker 304, which is kind of a vinyl shop.
Yeah.
It has all kinds of cool stuff. And then there's the Point Pleasant Trading Company, which is like another gift shop. But Mothman Museum has its own. When you go in the first part there, it has a lot of really well-done merchandise.
I think it is incredible, really, that so many people from around the world know this small town in West Virginia, Steve, just because of what happened in the 1960s. And I think it's one of those things that I've looked at some cases over there with some of these cryptids, and you can see these towns who have suffered this post-industrial age shutdown where people have moved away, and the shops are closing and the jobs are going and people are, and then all of a sudden some wise, forward-thinking person thinks, well, why don't we use our folklore to make people want to visit us? Because you only have to look. I mean, thousands of people come every year for the Mothman Festival. I know, was last year the first time it had been held since 2019 because of the pandemic, Steve?
No, it would be the last 2 years.
Yeah. As we were saying earlier on in the conversation, though, people come from all over the world. You know, I mean, it's on my bucket list. I want to come to Point Pleasant. I want to have my picture taken next to that statue. I want to listen to people like yourself and some of these up-and-coming whippersnappers like Chad Lewis and Kevin Lee Nelson cut their teeth addressing an audience or two, Steve. You know, that's something I've always wanted to do. And you just see that alone shows you the potential of a town council that thinks, let's go for this. Because that statue can't have been cheap, because it's a beautiful work of art.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Bob Roach is the man that created that 20 years ago.
Yeah. Because you look at somewhere similar, Van Meter, which, once again, nobody didn't know where Van Meter was if it wasn't for this story 110 years ago about the giant flying monster.
In fact, the first time I met Zelia Edgar was at the Van Meter Visitor Festival.
Ah.
we both spoke there.
Yeah.
And this is before she wrote her book. Mm. And I was sitting next to a friend of mine, and I said, you know, it sounds like she may have read John Keel. And then as she's going on, she's talking about the super spectrum and Trojan horse and the Mothman. I thought, holy cow.
Yes.
And she has a phenomenal book. She has just a great, great mind in applying Keelian principles.
Yes.
And so that was pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. She's an absolute rising star, and a book, as you say, a book's brilliant. Her YouTube channel's fantastic. And, I'm eagerly awaiting, because I know she's been working on a secret project for the last couple of years, Steve. So I'm very excited to see which direction she's turning, because as far as I'm aware, it's not what people would be expecting.
Hmm. Well, she's a very talented young lady.
She certainly is. She certainly is. And she's a welcome addition to a field with a sort of full respect for the history that's gone before her, I suspect.
It was fun because I would send her a book now and then.
Hmm.
Knowing that she's a young person with a great mind. If I had a duplicate or whatever, maybe a couple of things from Amazon, and then I would photocopy a lot of, you know, obscure articles and so forth. And I think some of that information made it into her book. So that was pretty nice.
Brilliant. Well, that's what we should all be doing. We should all be sharing the knowledge and the things that interest us and keep driving our passions, because long may it continue that the world is a strange thing if you're prepared to be as open-minded as you need to be, I think, Steve.
Absolutely.
So, Steve, where can everybody follow you online, listen to your podcast, and keep up to date with everything that's going on at the Mothman Museum?
Well, you can find me on Facebook, Steve Ward. If you type in Point Pleasant, you'll probably find me with no trouble. I do a show with Andy Mercer on the Paranormal UK Radio Network called The High Strangeness Factor. And I've been on a little bit of a hiatus when on the holiday, but we're going to get back at it. And I also am a correspondent on something called Mac Maloney's Military X-Files. And you can also find that on the same network and many other platforms. And that shows a real hoot sometimes. I usually do a fringe report, but it's kind of a free for all. We never know how it's going to turn out.
Excellent. Well, I'll put links to that. And obviously, Mothman Museum is fairly easily to track down. I know plans are already afoot for this year's festival, Steve. So have you been working on that with Jeff, or is it just a case of carry on doing what you guys have been doing?
Yeah, sometimes Jeff will call me in if he's going to have a big group of people or whatever, or to do an interview in the museum. So I'm always in contact with Jeff. I also have a book out called Mothman High Strangeness. Now, the artist is Mark Randall, great graphic artist, and it's all about the year of the Garuda, the Mothman, like 66 to 67. Mm. And he and I wrote the pieces for it. But it's got John Keel, the Man in Black, the bridge collapse, and so forth. And you can get that on Amazon.
Fabulous. Well, I'll put links to everything we've mentioned in regards to your shows and your podcast and your books and how they can track down the Mothman Museum as well online for everybody, Steve. And I just want to say thank you so much for your conversation and your time. It's been long, long, long overdue you joining me. And I hope it won't be the first time we speak. And thank you for such a wonderful conversation.
Well, I enjoy every minute of it, and look forward to coming back someday.